I speak a lot about Jewish history on this show. Why? Because the story of the Jewish people on planet Earth is an ongoing one. And if you don't approach modern Jewish experience as but a single point on a centuries-old continuum, you're simply not going to understand what's going on today. You have no frame of reference. You're like a child who wanders into the middle of a movie. You're out of your element, Donnie. And even those of us who think we know Jewish history forget how many instances of the same old anti-Jew hatred there have been across the globe, across societies, across the ages. So today, I'm going to give you a quick historical rundown of the most common anti-Jewish ideas and actions that have infected humanity throughout time. And I say quick because if I touched on every single example, we'd be here for eternity. I want to start with the OG, an event that wrote the playbook for all other Jew haters to follow for millennia to come. I'm talking, of course, about the world's first pogrom in Alexandria, Egypt in 38 CE. Destruction of synagogues by the local population at the behest of the ruling government? Check. The singling out of Jews alone as aliens and foreigners, despite the majority population being themselves imperial conquerors? Check. The dragging of Jews from all corners of the city into one small area, leaving their homes and belongings to be plundered by bloodthirsty, Jew-hungry mobs? Check. Thousands of Jews murdered in broad daylight by their neighbors, including the burning of entire families in their homes? Check. Jews stoned to death, beaten to death, crucified? Check, check, check. But equally important to grasp here are the anti-Jewish ideas, the foundational lies and twisted justifications for violence, which have never changed. According to the Egyptian orator Apion, who argued his case against the Jews before the Emperor Caligula in Rome, the Jews were trying to seize power, and from the Greeks, who were their clear racial superiors. The Jews were also engaged in strange demonic religious rituals, including the occasional cannibalism. And there we have four fundamental pillars of anti-Jew bigotry established thousands of years ago. Jews are a nefarious collective attempting to dominate society. Jews are biologically and racially inferior to whomever is the majority group. The Jewish religion is strange and evil, and Jews engage in monstrous, inhuman, ritualized blood sport. Anywhere you find Jew hatred, you find these four lies propping it up. Let's skip ahead a little to 313 CE, the Edict of Milan. Remember that from history class? Roman Emperor Constantine makes Christianity the official religion of the realm. Jews become widely discriminated against and isolated from society via legislative and legal means. The total dehumanization of Jews as a matter of official state policy. This practice will repeat itself again and again over the centuries, all the way through the Holocaust. Next, we come to the Middle Ages, a time so shitty they're known as being the ages between other ages. We've all heard of the Crusades, right? Officially, the Christian war to claim the Holy Land, aka Israel, from the Muslims. But might as well kill some Jews while we're at it, right? Jews are massacred by the thousands, forced to convert or die, then expelled entirely from both England and France. Three times, actually. Merci beaucoup. And once again, we establish several classic anti-Jewish ideas as justification for anti-Jewish violence that are all still very much in use today. The first is blood libel, a term I've discussed on here before, which basically means a false claim of demonic Jewish ritual killing of Christians and grotesque things like drinking their blood or using it to make matzah. We heard our boy Apion pop off about this back in the day, but it really took hold in 1171. When the Jews of Blois, France, were accused of crucifying a Christian child during Passover and throwing the corpse into the Loire, leading to 30 Jews being burned at the stake. Pretty blah, if you ask me. The second is religious hostility based on the notion that Jews killed Jesus, something someone on Instagram literally charged me with last week. Never mind that Jesus and all his disciples were Jews or that the Romans were in charge. Historical facts be damned. The third is money. Christian doctrine forbade the charging of interest on loans, so Jews, who were also banned from many other jobs, were the de facto moneylenders of the day, beginning the inversion of resentment over Jewish success into claims of Jews being money-hungry, avaricious, and cheats. This arrangement meant that non-Jews would often find themselves in debt to Jews, including the monarchs of England, France, and Spain, who all found it much easier to mass murder or expel Jews and seize their wealth rather than pay back their debts. The fourth is scapegoating. As European nations suffered from famine, military losses, even the bubonic plague, guess whose fault it was? Much easier to blame the tiny minority who can't possibly fight back than assume responsibility for your own poor governance or bad fortune. You've all heard 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, right? How about in 1492, Spain said, get the fuck out if you're a Jew. Jews had helped Ferdinand and Isabella finance their war against the Moors, but now that the war was done, so were the Jews. How's that for allyship? Let's take a trip to Germany, where Martin Luther, founder of his own branch of Protestantism, wrote a book called The Jews and Their Lies, describing Jews as a plague, pestilence, pure misfortune, and suggesting their synagogues and homes be burnt to the ground, their assets and sacred texts be seized, and their freedom of movement revoked. Cool guy. Italy saw its fair share of attacks on Jews via expulsions, ghettoization, and the burning of holy scriptures from Rome to Venice to Milan. The 17th century Cossack uprising, aimed at liberating Ukraine from Polish rule, somehow made Jews the primary victim, with 100,000 of them massacred in a single year. Even America got in on the fun. In 1862, the great liberator Ulysses S. Grant expelled Jews from southern states because of their involvement in the black market for cotton, which, of course, both the North and South heavily relied upon throughout the Civil War. But hey, if you can blame everything on the Jews, you just have to do it. In France, we witnessed the 1894 Dreyfus Affair, where Captain Alfred Dreyfus, the only Jewish high officer on general staff, was accused of being a spy based on forged evidence and despite knowledge of the actual non-Jewish culprit. It was this injustice that pushed Theodor Herzl, the father of Zionism, to conclude that if even a high officer was not immune from the anti-Jew bigotry of the majority, no one ever would be, and so began his pursuit of Jewish self-determination. In Russia, a falsified document called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion claimed to reveal a secret society of Jews who meant to conquer the world with the slyness of the serpent. Its widespread acceptance jump-started 20 years of deadly Russian pogroms and laid the foundation for today's ubiquitous conspiracy theories of Jews colluding to control the world. And of course, we have the Holocaust, which was, need I remind you, only 80 years ago. You think 40,000 people killed over 500 days during a modern urban war started by terrorists who hide under civilians is a genocide? During the Holocaust, over 300,000 Jews were murdered in under a year, just in Romania. Most of us probably don't even know where Romania is on the map. The question that naturally arises is why? Why the Jews? There must be some reason everyone hates them, right? Sure, there's a reason. It's because we're Jews. We're the teeny tiny minority who refuse to abandon our identity and our souls to please our masters. We celebrate life despite the constant presence of death. We succeed and contribute to society despite discrimination and oppression, and we continue to persevere against all odds. Qualities that arouse jealousy, bitterness, and self-loathing in those who fear the other. This basic animal fear is a very powerful social mobilizer for governments with agendas they need the populace to support. To see that idea in action, look no further than the Palestinians. From Yasser Arafat to Yahya Sinwar, Palestinian leaders have become literal billionaires, by stealing international aid intended for the masses, lining their own pockets rather than investing in the development of their people. And while Palestinian parents are focused on training their children to use machine guns to murder Jews, they're healthily distracted from the massive fraud being perpetrated against them by their own leaders, who don't even live there. Friends, we must reframe the way we think and talk about Jews today. For any concept of modern Jewish experience that does not account for our history of systemic persecution in every society we've ever lived in is a sham. It is not enough to just connect to the Holocaust, as if that was the first and only time Jews were ever murdered for being Jews. Do you realize how radical the notion of never again is, when from the dawn of time, the mass murder of Jews has been always again? And the persecution did not stop on VE Day. From the expulsions or deaths of nearly every MENA Jew in the Arab world, to the discrimination and suppression of Soviet Jewry in the 80s, to the mass shootings of Jews across America in the 2010s, to the Hamas atrocities of October 7th, that found support around the globe. The targeting of Jews is still happening. The continuum is continuing. Do not let yourself be gaslit into believing otherwise. There are only two things standing between us and further annihilation: the state of Israel and diasporic Jewish solidarity. That is it. If we each do everything we can to support those two things, maybe at last we can change the Jewish story. Maybe at last, when we say never again, it'll finally be true. This is the 24th episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. Years ago, my guest didn't have a single Jewish friend, by her own admission. Today, she's one of the staunchest and loudest supporters of Israel and the Jewish people anywhere on earth, using her international platform to deliver her signature no-bullshit breakdowns of Western hypocrisy and anti-Jew bigotry whenever they rear their ugly heads, which is probably why the poor woman is putting out new videos every 10 minutes. She's pissed off Russia, she's pissed off legacy news media, she's pissed off extremists on both sides, and we frickin' love her for it. She's a highly skilled orator, journalist, army brat, and doting mother. Ladies, gents, and legends, please welcome the saucy Aussie, Miss Erin Molan.
I reckon I've had about a million introductions over my 20 years in public life. That has essentially beaten all of them to a pulp. Yes. That was phenomenal.
Thank you. I take a lot of care and pride with my intros, so it's very validating to hear you say that.
But I'm also trying to now think about anyone I knew 2 years ago who was Jewish who now realizes I didn't consider them a friend.
Oops.
So I'm gonna go through that now as well. But Jonah, thank you so much for having me. It's honestly, if you told me a couple of years ago that my stance on this conflict would have put me into a minority group, I would have told you, you are crazy.
Yeah.
If you told me that standing staunchly against a democratic nation who was a victim of one of the worst terrorist attacks in recent times, the greatest loss of Jewish life, that my stance with them against the terrorists who committed these atrocities would have been controversial, I would have told you, you are joking. But here we are. The world is a funny place.
Erin, I really want to introduce my audience to you. I know a lot of people are already familiar with your work. Some are not. But even if they are, they might not know much about the woman behind the work. So I want to start back at the beginning. You were raised mostly in Indonesia, is that right?
Yeah, I lived 7 years in Indonesia from the early 90s for 3 or 4 years and then the late 90s. So fairly formative years, so kind of 8, 9, 10, 11 and then mid to late teens. And a particularly, I guess, important time as well for that country in 1998 when the Suharto regime fell after 30 years of pretty corrupt power, one bloke in charge that essentially his children owned every major piece of infrastructure. And I watched a country as a young person stand up and fight for democracy and freedom. And it shaped, you know, a lot of the way that I see the world today.
That's so interesting. I mean, I was going to ask, in talking about things that shape the way you see the world, your father was a major general in the army. So you moved around a ton. So you had that part as, you know, formative and also, you know, an inside view to the army and politics through your father. So how did those pieces help shape the woman you've become and the path that you've been on?
Yeah, Dad was probably has been and was the greatest influence on my life, and very blessed to have a dad that also is my hero in many ways. And I know a lot of people feel like that about their dads, and it's a very special thing. I also know a lot of people don't have the privilege of feeling that way about their dads. So I feel very lucky to have had someone that not only loved us and was incredibly present and amazing as a dad, but was also someone who was just so phenomenally brave and courageous and strong and stood up for what mattered at any cost and, you know, would do whatever was required of him to serve our nation and serve this country. And, you know, our dinner party conversations at night weren't really about what was on TV that day or, you know, things that might be more regular and normal, we would talk about ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and we would talk about the rising threat of China and the government over there. And, you know, I didn't have many friends over for dinner often, as you can imagine, probably why.
They were just, you know, eyes open, mouth closed, no idea what to say.
Yeah, it was a little bit intense, but I developed very early a massive passion in this space. But randomly enough, my career took me to sports journalism initially, and I spent 15 years hosting rugby league, hosting sports in Australia, the tennis. I was the first woman to host a lot of different male sports in Australia. But then about 3 years ago, the calling came to move into this space, and it had always been my passion. You know, I think you get to a stage where you get a little bit sick of talking about blokes' groins at 11 p.m. on a Friday night and decide there's got to be more to life. And this was my passion always, and I have no life. I immerse myself in this stuff 24/7 as well as being a mum. And, yeah, now I feel like I've never worked in a space, and it sounds so wanky, I know, but never worked in a space that feels more authentically me. You know, I would be talking about this to people if I didn't work in this space professionally. I'm obsessed by it. I live and breathe it. And I feel closer to my dad than ever since he passed away a couple of years ago, which is really beautiful, because when he died, I struggled immensely to feel close to him. And people would say, no, you can talk to him. And he's there, he's still there, but I never felt that. But over the past few months, I keep thinking, you know, I wish you could see this, Dad. I wish you could see the president of Israel hosting me and quoting my own work back to me, you know, with his wife. I just, he would be immensely proud, I hope, and I'm sure he would be.
I'm sure he would be as well. And hearing you talk about him and what you feel you've learned from him and then seeing it in action with the work you're doing now it's amazing. I'm a dad myself, and I could only hope that the same would happen with my own children. So it's a beautiful thing. You started in sports for a long time, and then you transition into, you know, having your own public affairs show. How did that transition come about?
I'd always loved this space, but I was getting incredible opportunities in sport, and, you know, was busy enough with that. So I'd never really considered. I thought maybe later in my career I might transition over and move into this, but not when I did. That came a little bit earlier. I did an interview with the newspaper, and they'd asked me about a certain game, and I'd said something to them to the effect of, I actually didn't watch that rugby league game, even though it's my job to host it. I was watching the local state elections in South Australia, which for anyone who's in Australia would know that it doesn't get more boring or mundane than that kind of thing, watching a count of a state election. And one of the bosses at Sky News saw that and thought, you know, maybe she's more suited to being with us. And it was always something that I planned on doing down the track. But once it happened, I never, as I said, never felt more at home in terms of the content that I was covering. I was nervous. Even Dad, I think, was a little bit nervous as to how I'd go, because they're very different fields, clearly.
Sure.
But I think because this was what I'd do for fun. You know, I'd watch Fox News, I'd watch CNN. This was always my passion. Now it just feels like home to me.
That's amazing. It shows, and I can certainly relate. Before October 7th, how much was the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on your radar? How much exposure did you have to it? What did you know about it?
Yeah, not a huge amount. It wasn't something that we covered in great detail in Australia. To be honest, I was fully, knee-deep in Ukraine and Russia, and that was the biggest thing we would talk about when it came to foreign affairs and the region and war, et cetera, et cetera. I knew to an extent the basics. You know, I've followed it. Dad was fairly involved. He went to Israel in 2014, because that's what we do in the world. We send generals from other countries to check on Israel and make sure they're doing the right thing. So Dad was part of this contingent of retired generals who went to investigate the conflict in 2014. And I remember his headline, which Mum sent to me only recently, which said, they put us to shame in how they conduct wars. And Dad's moral compass could not be moved in any way, shape or form. He was phenomenal. He was an incredible general in every way, and he was uncompromising when it came to following the rule of law, because he would say, if we don't, what are we fighting for? What are we fighting to protect if we lower ourselves to the levels of our enemy? So I always remember thinking that was quite incredible at that stage as well. But no, it just wasn't really on the radar here. You know, you'd have moments and you'd hear about violence and that might be covered in the news. But in terms of it being something that was all consuming, that was essentially on October 7 and beyond.
My, how things have changed.
It still blows my mind that there are people, even around me, family, et cetera, that don't you know, that, that aren't as attached to this as I am, with hostage releases, with the Bebas babies, with that, that people aren't thinking about it 24/7. It blows my mind. But you know, for a lot of people, I guess they're not, and it's not their focus. But it has been, apart from being a mom and my little girl, it's been the biggest focus of my life for a year and a half, because I feel it matters too much. And I wish my voice wasn't required in this space. I wish my voice was one of millions that was saying the right thing and telling the truth, but it's not, unfortunately.
Sometimes that's the way it goes when it comes to Jewish causes for a teeny tiny minority. Mm-hmm. Do you remember when you first became aware of what happened on October 7th?
Yeah, it's in the room that I'm in now. I was in bed with my daughter, and I've now turned it into a half wardrobe, half studio. But I remember it so vividly because it was the first time Dad had passed away 10 months earlier, and I'd never forgotten, as in I'd never, people talk sometimes when they lose someone close. I went to text him, or I went to call him, or I went to, I'd not done that in 10 months. And I woke up and I started to see these alerts coming through. And for the first time since Dad died, I went to call him. Mm. I forgot momentarily. And that, I remember that so vividly, but it was sickening. You know, it was, I'd heard so many stories out of Iraq regarding the things that Al-Qaeda and ISIS did, things that, that you wouldn't even read publicly, you know, things that, that I was privy to. Having, you know, someone who served over there and saw firsthand. But I was just sickened to the pit of my stomach, and it was hard to fathom, I think, for me, even though I understood Hamas and what they were about and what they stood for and what their objective was. I think the depravity of it even then was really difficult to comprehend, having then watched the raw vision when I went to Israel just a few months ago.
Yeah.
That even went to another level. I still could not have envisaged how evil and depraved they are.
Now that you've been doing this work for the last year and a half, can you identify any reasons why something that is so uncomplicated is so not easily understood by people who are otherwise, you know, intelligent people?
I mean, I'm used to kind of idiots not comprehending pretty simple, basic things. But I think when I see people whom I might have previously thought to be fairly impressive in their fields spewing this Hamas propaganda, it confuses me even more. Look, I think they're very, and when I say they're, I'm talking about all those who fund, who contribute to Hamas, Iran, the entire thing, the regime over there. They have a very sophisticated program that they have been running for a long, long time, and they seem to embed themselves in places where people are young and vulnerable, left-leaning as well, of course, and all of a sudden the truth just gets completely lost. And what frustrates me so much in this space is that there's this mentality that if you care about kids in Gaza, how could you ever stand with Israel? Oh my gosh, you know, I care about kids. Like, you're a mother. I thought you cared. You do all this charity work. You care. Of course I care. I care deeply about little babies born into that hell and that evil of Hamas, but I just understand who their enemy is.
Right.
That's the difference. And that's what I can't fathom, is that it's so simple. Children in Gaza die because the terrorists there invade Israel, kill people, take hostages back, and then continue to try and kill Israel using weapons they embed within the women and the children whilst they hide in tunnels. Like it's not complex, it's not grey, it's the most simple thing in the world. There's not even two sides. There's good and then there are evil terrorists. It's not like two countries decided they wanted to battle it out over some kind of legitimate thing and they went to war. Like, these are evil terrorists who invaded, killed a whole hell of a lot of people, took a whole hell of a lot of people back, and have said publicly, you don't need to be Cluedo or Einstein. They have said over and over and over again that they will continue to attempt to kill every Jewish Israeli person. So what is Israel supposed to do? What were they supposed to do? You can differentiate in how you believe they should conduct this operation, absolutely, but their right to dispose of evil terrorists who are promising to kill them, having killed 1,200 of them, how can anyone question that?
I think something that you raise that, you know, is so bothersome for me is that someone would rather, for example, believe that you as a mother must hate Gazan children then consider that there might be something else to the story, or at least worth discussing with you. Isn't that crazy?
And the thing is, you mentioned Indonesia before. So I grew up you know, the world's largest Islamic population.
Right.
There are people in Indonesia who are family to me, and they are all Muslim. I speak the language of the world's largest Islamic population, the country of Indonesia, fluently. Besok pagi saya akan pergi ke toko, mungkin nanti itu saya akan tidur karena saya capek.
What did you just say?
Nothing intense. I think I said I'm going to go have a nap later because I'm tired, then I might go to the shops. Okay. Pretty basic. But my point being is that you can't come at me and say you don't care about Muslim children, you're Islamophobic. It's crazy. Terrorism hurts those babies, Muslim babies, more than it hurts anyone else. Mm-hmm. My fight is for them as much as it is for children in Israel and all over the world who are going to be hurt by these evil scumbag terrorists. So it's crazy the things they come at you with. But and then when you show empathy or you talk about it, you know, you get accused of white woman tears.
Ugh.
And what it demonstrates to me without any doubt whatsoever is that they have no argument.
Right.
If they are trying to prosecute the most ridiculous arguments that are so obviously false, they've got no argument.
You lean on the insults. You lean on the name calling. You lean on the demonizing because you got nothing
Absolutely.
Else to say.
And then you start into silence. People go, oh, gosh, I don't want people to think that I don't care about kids in Gaza, and people stop talking.
Yeah.
And they win. When you stop, they win, which is why I won't stop. I don't stop. I'll never stop. You know, they don't hurt me anymore because I know what I stand for, and I know that I stand for every beautiful, innocent child all over the world, and I understand that their enemy in Gaza is Hamas, not Israel.
What were the reactions at work from your colleagues and bosses at Sky the first time you come out and you take this clear, direct road and this becomes your thing?
They were all great. Look, they're, if you watch Sky News Australia, they're one of the most pro-Israel networks. Right. And when I say pro-Israel, anti-terror networks. So look, there was a lot of talk surrounding my leaving Sky, but if you watch the network, there's a Jewish presenter on there who's phenomenal. A lot of the people there are phenomenal in terms of standing with Israel against terrorism. So look, they were great. They were fine. People on other networks who I'd worked for didn't seem as pleased with my take. There's probably no other network in Australia that broadcasts the kind of stuff that Sky News do or that I do. But you know what? In terms of people disliking it or not agreeing, I say to them, show me wherever I have ever said anything that is controversial. Point out anywhere that I have said anything that would be considered controversial or against the values that I've stood for from day one, which is peace, freedom, democracy. I'm an overly empathetic person. I care way too much. I get so emotional. Even the thought of a child being hungry makes me feel physically ill. Point out where I have not fought for every child in Gaza as hard as I fought for every child in Israel. So, you know, it's a great way to cull people out of your life because, to be honest, if you enable people like Hamas or if you enable people who enable Hamas, then I don't want you in my life anyway.
Hear, hear. I'm curious, what's the process for you for writing your monologues? What do you go through to get those prepped? Because they're so fantastic. I write monologues for my show. I know what a difficult process that is. I'm interested to hear what yours is.
Yeah, no, I love that question. So basically, I used to do them once a week because my show at Sky was once a week.
Right.
So throughout the whole week, I would screenshot and I'd have just a note section in my phone. So anything I would see where I'd go, you hypocrite, I would screenshot it. I'd be listening to the radio and I'd hear this, day 400 and something of Israel's illegal invasion of Gaza. I'd be like, what? They're illegal? What? I'd make a note. I'd make a voice note and I'd save it all in this folder and then I'd sit down on the Friday morning before my show and just scroll through and just write. And it's incredible how, I mean, sometimes, most of the time, if I'm being completely honest, I mean, when I used to write columns for the newspaper, I would say it would sometimes get more stuck and it would take me a little bit longer. But these just come so naturally to me. And the more I do of them, you know, I remember before starting at Sky and all the hosts would do these really powerful monologues at the start, not necessarily in this space, but on politics and Australian politics and domestic issues and whatever else. And I would think, oh, gosh, I'm not going to be able to do that in any way that's powerful or making, you know, making an impact like they do. And so I was already making excuses going, well, I'm just going to do more interviews and go longer on interviews because I just don't think I'm going to be able to write things the way they do and et cetera, et cetera. Then when I started, I kind of have now come to the conclusion that they're probably the most powerful thing that I do. Yeah. And I write exactly how I feel. And I think for me the delivery of them is the key because – you know, I write every word myself. So it's not like I have a team or producers or writers who do it. So I think the reason they make an impact and the reason people, you know, they resonate with people is because it's genuinely just me. It's my thoughts. It's how I feel. If there's emotion, I'll show emotion. If I'm angry, I'll show a bit of anger. If I'm being cheeky, I'll be a little bit cheeky, but it's just genuinely how I feel. And so that's it. So even now at the moment I have, you know, it's I call it bat beep crazy, right? Because that's just what I've always to start my little segments. But now you'll see I've got, you know, different things like the BBC and the documentary, and I'll write little notes and that kind of thing. And this is why I'm about to write it after we finish now. But it's just a whole heap of anything. And to be honest, I'll probably use 20% of it, but I've always been always have more, and then I'll go through and whatever I feel is still relevant or is powerful enough to still be relevant, even if it's a couple of days old, or if I think I've got a clever take on something, then I'll use it. But it's just a whole compilation of things I've seen that have made me go, what the hell? And yeah, and then I kind of put it together and deliver it.
I love that. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for asking.
One of the videos that you did a while ago that I thought was great was where you called out the UN and the UN special rapporteur, Francesca Albanese. She's flat out denying Hamas rapes and violence against women. And you yourself are a survivor of horrific domestic violence. What does that feel like to see institutionalized denial of violence against women?
Look, it's hard. And I think what frustrated me so much about her and about that is that if we were talking about any other group in the world, including me, there would not even be room for one iota of doubt ever that would be ever expressed publicly, because you just wouldn't. As if you wouldn't believe women like that. That's and to be honest, the left take that to the extent that is almost sometimes dangerous as well, in that, okay, but we also need people to have, you know, it has to be tested in some way, shape or form. What frustrated me so much about her is that we have so much evidence and she still could not acknowledge. And I only recently came out with my story mid last year, so maybe 6 months ago. I've never spoken about it. The thought of people feeling sorry for me or thinking I'm a victim makes me deeply uncomfortable. It still does even now. But I'd been asked many, many times to come out because people thought it would help people, and I think it did, and I'm glad that I did. But when I came out with my story, the number of feminists and people who just showered me in this incredible support, sending me messages, doing public things, how brave Erin is to share her story. And then October 7 happened, and all of a sudden we're seeing all of this and, you know, reports coming out about what actually happened to women. We're seeing women bent out of shape. We're seeing women with blood on the back of their pants. And they're silent. These exact same women who came out publicly to support me were suddenly silent about Jewish women who were exposed, and this was much bigger than just my story, which was really only a story in Australia. This was massive, and yet they were silent. And it just, you know, it drives me crazy. I think Albanese is one of the most dangerous, you know, people of our time when it comes to this issue, and she is doing a great disservice to the people that she is meant to be helping. And if she deeply cares about women, if she deeply cares about children in Gaza, then she would be standing up for their right to exist without terrorists within and amongst them every day of the week. The greatest gift she could ever give women, children, innocent people in Gaza would be the eradication of Hamas, the terrorists who are responsible for their pain and suffering and always have been. So, yeah, she's dangerous.
Would you say that was your first exposure to this idea of Jews don't count, which as a Jew, we're quite familiar with and has been going on for some time?
I had no idea, legitimately no idea. I obviously understood the Holocaust and I knew that, you know, the horrific things that had happened to your people in the past. But particularly even in Australia, to people would stop me in the street. This is over the last few years when Dad was still alive, and Jewish people in Australia, and say, you know, your dad's amazing. He's such a great ally of our community. And I'd smile and say, oh, isn't he the best? He's lovely. Nice to meet you. And then I'd walk away and think, why do you need allies? Like that just, it was a bizarre thing to me, like thinking you're living in relative peace. Well, you are here in Australia and blah, 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 blah. And then when October 7 happened, and I think, you know, the moment it hit me was, wait a minute, there is not an IDF boot on the ground in Gaza yet, and I am seeing Australians in front of our iconic buildings celebrating that. and chanting, you know, vile slurs towards Jews and at the Jews. And I went, okay, wait a minute. And that was one thing, right, to have like people celebrating, you know, pro-Hamas. But then I started to see it in circles that I would never have thought would have ever not stood up immediately to support a minority group who was doing it tough or who had just been subjected to what the Jewish population had been subjected to. So, yeah, it was, and it was a real eye-opener for me. I guess I was naive. I didn't understand. But to be honest, a lot of people I've spoken to who are Jewish and who are in this field in particular of anti-Semitism and other things have said they did not even realize how much was bubbling under the surface.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think we were all shocked and surprised by the amount of hate just ready to rip. But there were troubling signs and increasing data on anti-Semitism growing and growing and growing, building up to this. This was a good excuse to let it all out. So the monologue that you did that introduced me to you was the one after the killing of Sinwar. That was the first time I saw you. I was like, who is this gorgeous blonde Australian with a hostage pin who is nailing Western leaders to the wall? And it was so, this is like the Aaron special. It's like blistering in its clarity and also deeply felt. To me, that's sort of like your secret sauce. And, you know, you were talking about Biden, talking about Harris, talking about your own foreign minister, Penny Wong. And you said, this victory, the killing of Sinwar, is in spite of you, not in any way because of you. How did those elected to lead us fail so miserably?
The rage that I felt and I still feel is very authentic and genuine because, and as I've said since, look, I haven't figured out why. I think they're just weak. I don't think there is an actual answer to any of it. But when I look at the reaction of world leaders in the aftermath, you know, that not one came out and said what they needed to say. And it wasn't rocket science. It wasn't hard. You know, you can say, this is awful, thoughts and prayers. This is awful, thoughts and prayers. Let's go to Canada. This is awful, thoughts and prayers. Let's go to, so this is awful thought. You think that's going to stop a bunch of terrorists? I mean, if the world had united and come together, and when I say the world, I'm talking about their leaders, and said, not on our watch, you scumbags. You have 24 hours to, you know, blah. We would never have seen what we have seen play out. We would never have seen the deaths in Gaza. We would never have seen the extent of suffering in Israel and the Jewish community around the world. It's hard for me to fathom. I look at Argentina's new president and Milei, and he makes the point, and this is a translation, but something to the effect of, when you finish in politics, most people will hate you, and that's a given. So you might as well do what you believe is right when you are there. And I just can't imagine that every politician who was weak and terrified was doing what they really thought was right. They were doing what they thought they needed to do to placate very loud minority groups and very left extremist on both sides elements that they were trying to placate and cater to. And I just, you know, if a leader can't stand up when terrorists come and murder 1,200 people, burn children alive in rooms, do the most horrific, I watch the Raw Vision, every second of it. If leaders can't stand up and say, we don't stand for this, then I mean, how screwed is the world? And not even on behalf of another nation, by the way. It's not even that you are wondering, you know, do you guys mind, because we're allies, coming to help us, support us, even just your rhetoric. We don't actually need your soldiers or anything else, just your rhetoric. It was our people. There were Australians involved. There were Canadians. There were Americans. There were people from the UK. Their own citizens were involved in this, yet their weakness, as I said just this week, weakness in high places and high doses in spades. And it just, all it did, Hamas must have just, in Iran, must have been going, God, even we didn't think that they, oh, God. Hey, have you, what, man, we thought.
We're going to get away with this.
They would have thought, you know what, we'll get the university students and we'll get those bloody, you know, knobs over there who'll march for us in the streets and wear. But we didn't, I mean, God, even we couldn't have envisaged it to go this well. Like, it's crazy. The whole thing is crazy. And all it did was empower, embolden and enable the terrorists to do what they've done thus far. And then they'll all, oh, Israel, how dare you have killed so many people in Gaza. You are the ones that forced this to go for 18 months by your weakness, and not even your weakness, but you imposed that weakness on Israel and its response to what occurred. So, you know, they are so complicit in this, and it's been shameful to watch.
It's going to be a long time until we can collectively look back, and I think these people will realize everything that you just said.
Absolutely. They will be remembered very vividly for what they did and did not do over this time.
So you mentioned again that when you were in Israel, let's get to it now, you watched that raw footage. I saw it as well when I was in Israel. Absolutely horrific things. The first, you know, 3 seconds, you're like, okay, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. What do you think about, as a journalist, Israel's strategy, let's call it, of not dispersing that footage everywhere out of, you know, respect for the victims, I guess, but withholding really powerful images that do a lot of the work for them?
It's another great question. I'll start by saying the fact that Israel needs a PR strategy after October 7 is mind-blowingly crazy on every level, but they do, and let's just acknowledge they do.
Yeah.
It's a really difficult situation. When it comes to families of people who have lost loved ones, how do you ever make them go through more pain than they are already going through if they are uncomfortable with that? But I would look at President Trump. Literally hours after he watched the raw vision, he came out, and that's when he went, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, because he saw. Anyone who has watched it, Rubio, there are different politicians and people, and even their reactions to media, it is a complete, it changes everything, you seeing that. I thought I understood what occurred on that day. I'd read so many reports. I'd seen filtered images that I didn't think could have gotten any worse. When I sat down there and watched it, someone asked me at an event last week in Melbourne about putting the vision out there. And to be honest, I think you should.
I agree.
And it's not okay to give permission and you know, that's something that Israel needs to determine with families and manage with families. And I can't imagine their pain, and I'm not them. But it would be close to impossible unless you are so latched on and so full of propaganda and evil and malice for anyone to watch what I watched and walk away and then go and wave a flag to support them. It would be impossible. Yeah. And I think the issue that we have is because it hasn't been fully out there, people are listening to other people's perspective on it. Mm-hmm. And there are so many agendas. Media organizations generally lean to the left. So they are full of people who, A, haven't even watched it themselves, and B, are being completely consumed by propaganda. You know, I think about Cindy, who's a 45-year-old single mother, lives in Western Sydney. Cost of living crisis is making life bloody dreadful for her. She's got 3 kids, they're nightmares. She gets 30 seconds on the radio as she gets out of the car on this conflict, and she hears that one little bit that I told you about earlier, Israel's illegal invasion of Gaza, and she thinks, oh, God, I saw that image of that baby in Gaza the other night. Israel are awful.
Yep.
She doesn't then go and read 10 articles about it like I do daily because I'm entrenched in this. She doesn't think about it again. That has shaped her narrative. So for most people, it's not that they're malicious. It's not that they don't want to, you know, engage or know the truth. They don't have the capacity or the privilege of being able to give time to understanding it. So unless we have raw vision that people can see, and unless you put that out there, I mean, it doesn't even need to be the gruesome stuff, right? Like it doesn't actually, I watched Hamas hack a man's head off.
That's the one that sticks out the most to me, the Thai worker.
Yes. So hacked a head off, and their faces, they weren't even bothered by it, Hamas.
It wasn't even Hamas. It was civilians, and they hacked it off with a garden hoe.
It is repulsive. Yeah. But I tell you the thing for me as a mom and as a parent, my greatest fear in life is not being able to protect my child. And that is the same for any parent. The dad with his son under his arm and the other boy running, and the look on the dad's face knowing that terrorists were coming and he could not protect his children will haunt me for the rest of my life. There is so much in there that I think would have such a big impact. But then, you know, I mean, what we've seen should be enough. Like what's out there should be enough. But I just feel like if that's not enough, if they could get the families to agree, then I think it should go to everyone and anyone because it matters. You need to see this stuff to understand why Israel cannot exist next to Hamas.
I certainly agree with you. Have you, since going down this path, you know, whatever you do in life, you're going to get love, you're going to get hate. Have you been feeling the love from the Jewish and Israeli community?
Incredibly. It's been overwhelming. You know, I feel like I've suddenly got, how many of you are
Jews? Like 16 million or something, between 15, 17? That's amazing.
You get some pretty nasty stuff in this space, and I'm pretty battle-hardened with all of that by now, which helps.
Yeah.
But the love is, and it, you know, people often will, I mean, daily I'll get often thousands and people will start, I'm sure you get a million of these and I'm sure I'm one of, I read every single one and every single one helps me when I find it hard. And there are moments when I find it hard. There are moments when I struggle with the thought that I am potentially endangering my six-year-old because of what I do. And I counter that by saying I'm fighting for a world that will be a safe world for her when she's older. And this fight is for her. Every second that I do and speak and fight and campaign in this space is for her ultimately. But in the short term, there is absolutely an added risk. And every time I start to think, is this worth it? Is this latest death threat? Is this one that looks legitimate? Is this security that guard that I need to be with me 24/7 at this? Is there? And then I get a message from someone saying, thank you. I felt so alone. And it helps immensely. So what I'm saying is keep them coming. Look, it's beautiful. You are the most resilient, incredible community I've ever encountered. And if you were any other minority group, you would be surrounded in the love that you deserve and the support that you deserve. And I'm just so sad that you're not.
I think it's so important that the people watching this show hear what you just said, because I think a lot of people think they're thanking into the void, or that whoever they're thanking, you know, doesn't care or doesn't make an impact. Clearly it does. And it's important. I think, to thank the people who stand with us. I'm actually involved with an organization called One Mitzvah a Day, which anybody can check out, onemitzvahaday.org. And every day we send a little text message that you just click and it populates an email to thank some person or politician or organization that has done something to stand with the Jewish people or with Israel. Because
and that is beautiful, but how screwed up is the world that you feel you need to thank us for standing with you against evil terrorists? I mean, it's so beautiful getting all these messages, but it breaks my heart that people feel the need to thank me. It should just be a given. It's awful.
You're no stranger to backlash or harassment online. Well before this, tell us about Australia's Online Safety Act, aka Aaron's Law.
So this was something that I was incredibly passionate about, and I'd like to say I would have hoped that it was working more effectively, particularly given what I'm exposed to now.
Need to tweak Aaron's Law a little bit.
Just a little tweak. Look, this was always predominantly about kids for me and about making sure that what was illegal in the real world was illegal online. That was it, basically, and trying to protect kids from this space that was completely, in a lot of ways, unrestricted. That's something I'm immensely proud of. My daughter came with me to Parliament House and that was put into legislation. We raised so much awareness. It's legislation that is intended to protect people online. I'm not particularly pleased with some of the ways in which they're trying to use it that go into censorship as opposed to what I fought for, which was death threats, things that you would not be able to do in real life. You cannot set threat to a child online. For me, it's keeping kids safe online. And when I started to talk about what, you know, adults were being exposed to and how it impacted me as an adult woman with great support around me, it crippled me at times. I'll be completely honest. It doesn't now, but it used to 5-10 years ago. It was debilitating at times and very hard for me to deal with. So I would think, how could kids ever handle this? So that was the intent. I think what it did was raise a lot of awareness around these issues online, and parents took note, and hopefully kids are much safer online.
I think it's an awesome accomplishment. I'm curious, how has this, you know, new trajectory you've been on affected your career, for better or worse?
It's crazy, right? Define success. And that's what I am doing a lot of lately in terms of what is this trajectory in my career? Because if I define success on never being sacked, which I hadn't been up really up until this point, then it would be near, it would be the lowest point because I lost basically every job I had last year. But in terms of reaching audiences and doing meaningful work like that, like incredible. So I think for me, the biggest thing at the moment, because I care so deeply about this space and what's going on in the world around this conflict in the Middle East, for me, the biggest thing I want is to reach as many people as possible. And so for me, I think it's been the greatest blessing in disguise the end of last year, losing all my kind of legacy media jobs and moving into this kind of independent space that I'm in now. In terms of reach, you know, 29 million views since I left Sky News of my work, which has been incredible. A new show I've just started hosting on X, 69 X Minutes, had 10 million views just, you know, a couple of days ago. So, look, I've had so many opportunities. I've got offers sitting there. But to be honest, at the moment, my focus is this. And, you know, I got this letter from a guy in Outback Australia, in Western Australia, who was a miner. And I love this because I love speaking to you. I love that you and your community love me, but you're not my target audience. You believe and agree with everything I say. My job is not to convince other people. It is to deliver my truth in a way that I believe is authentic and just expose them to a different way of thinking. And I got this letter back from this guy who said, "Aaron, I just wanted to let you know I'm a miner, you know, blah, blah, blah. I just watched one of your videos and I wanted to tell you that my morals and my values haven't changed, but the side that I now realize they align with has. Thank you." And he had a number and I rang him and he said, "You know, I just was seeing all these images on the news of babies in Gaza and Israel was killing them." And he said, I didn't understand it. I didn't, you know, not because I didn't care. It's just what I was being told and you believe it." And he said, "Then I watched one of your videos and I went, oh my gosh, now I get it. Now I get why standing with Israel is standing up for those babies in Gaza." And I think to me that is, in terms of career tick off, in terms of achievement and success, that email epitomizes everything I'm hoping to do in this space, which is reach as many people as possible, not for egotistical reasons, not because I want to be a big deal. I've been famous in Australia for 20 years. It's not much chop. Let me tell you, there is a lot of downside to it. But because I want to change the world in a good way and I want to open people's eyes in a good, positive way for everyone, including babies in Gaza.
You mentioned your reach is higher than ever, but you're sacked from some jobs. You, when asked why you were let go from Sky, you said budget. If you're not allowed to say anymore because you signed an NDA, blink twice.
I did not sign an NDA, definitely. All I was told budget. Okay. And look, again, I will say Sky has been very, very good in this space and they've got a lot of amazing presenters who do amazing things in this space. So look, I'm inclined to, I was told budget and I guess that's, you know, I'm inclined to believe it, I guess. Okay. As in, I don't think it's the other thing, but what the reason is, I don't know, but it's definitely not because of my stance on this conflict, because there are other people who are very, very pro-Israel in this space.
Well, that's good to hear. Speaking of Israel, right after things end with Sky, you go to Israel like 2 weeks later. How did that trip come about?
I was already booked in to do that trip. And, you know, it turned into a much bigger trip than I'd ever kind of thought it would be. But it was a quick trip. My daughter was going away with her dad over the holiday period. And so I had, I think, 5 days and I thought, I'm going to go now because I don't like to leave her when she's here and in routine. And so I had a window and I wanted to go over and see for myself, not because I needed to see to believe or anything like that. I think it's very obvious I believed from the second that this occurred, but I felt like I needed to go over and see and stand at the Nova Music Festival, go to the kibbutz, watch the Raw Vision, speak to people in person who were there, because I thought that would enable me to do what I'm trying to do even more effectively and with even more integrity. And that was why. So I went over, and it was mind blowing. You know, I didn't kind of do any fun stuff or get to experience a lot of the culture or the nightlife or anything like that. I'm sure I'll have plenty of time. I've got a couple of trips coming up over the next couple of months. Amazing. Or so. Look, at some stage I'll get to experience Israel for what it is, the vibrant, incredible country with a zest and a love for life. But this trip was about going to the places where these horrors occurred so that I could communicate as rawly and as honestly as I could what I saw and what I heard and back to the world, basically.
And you also had the opportunity to meet with President Herzog while you were there, as you mentioned. How meaningful was that? What'd you guys talk about? How was that?
Oh, it was incredible. You know, I didn't expect it to be what it was, to be honest. I didn't expect to kind of be seated up there next to them and have them almost, you know, host me and thank me. And I think, you know, it was quite surreal. I mentioned earlier to have the president quote my own words back to me. You know, when you said about the three things required for terrorism to, you know, it's just, it was mind blowing to me that someone like him and his wife, who was so impressive as well,
yeah,
could watch work and be buoyed by it and think that it was significant and important was incredible. We spoke about the Pope a little bit as well. The Pope's comments had come out a little bit earlier. He hasn't been, you know, particularly staunch an ally of Israel throughout this conflict. And we talked about Indonesia as well. You know, we talked a fair bit about Indonesia. I'd been in Indonesia just before that trip and met with the new foreign minister over there. And obviously Indonesia, 300 million people, big players, biggest Muslim country in the world, big players in this space. So he and I actually had a fairly good chat about Indonesia and my contacts in Indonesia and different things that might be happening with that country too. So it was an incredible meeting and I was really honored and blown away that they thought that I was special enough to I guess, to deserve it.
That's very cool. Earlier on in this year and a half, you said the following. You said, I'm not actually pro-Israel. I'm anti-terror. I'm anti-murder, anti-kidnapping of babies, etc. With all that's transpired since and you having been to Israel, where are you at with that now? Do you still feel the same way?
Oh, look, and the reason I made that is because people kept saying, oh, you're so pro-Israel, you're so... And I'd be like, you don't actually even need to be pro... So it's not that I'm not pro-Israel, but the point I'm making is you don't actually need to be pro-Israel to stand with Israel against what is this evil threw at them. You know, I find this whole thing bizarre. I look at, you know... You don't have to agree on every single way that Israel has prosecuted this war against Hamas. You don't have to at all to vehemently agree with the fact that they have every single right to defend themselves, to destroy their enemies who have committed to continue killing them, and to get their people back however they feel they can do it best. And I, you know, that is a hill I will die on. Absolutely, in terms. So I stand with Israel, absolutely, but you don't need to condemn and to stand against their enemies is the point that I'm making with that.
Understood. So you mentioned this earlier, but I want to come back to it. You are now hosting this new show, 69X Minutes, which came about because Elon Musk tweeted, hey, does anybody want to make 69X Minutes? I'll fund it. And then like, it felt like 3 days later you had a show that you were hosting.
Look, I can't take credit for any of that. Mario, who's a, you know, he hosts the biggest show on X, he and his team have put it all together and came to me fairly late in the piece and asked if I would host it. So, look, they've done it all, and it's, I think it's great. I think for X, it's now the number one news site in so many different countries around the world. People are looking to get their news when it happens directly and also longer form. So look, Elon's retweeted a little bit of it and liked it. He liked my post yesterday about how many views it had. So he's pushing for much more news content. I met with the X team, and including the CEO and head of news, a couple of days ago, and they are really serious about turning X into the first place that anyone goes for news. And I'm just excited to be there and experimenting and having a go with it all.
And how many episodes are you signed on for? Like, what's the plan?
Nothing official as yet. So I made a promise to myself when this all happened that I would not lock myself into anything too quickly. So at the moment, I'm abstaining from doing anything like that. I'm just doing things that feel right and feel good at the time. And I have not signed a thing, locked myself into anything with anyone. I'm just doing my own thing. And if projects come along that appeal to me, then I'm happy to jump on and we'll see.
And did Elon actually fund it?
I don't think so. I mean, if he is, I need to ask for a pay rise, clearly. Yeah.
Let's end with this. Can you leave us with any parting words for the allies in my audience who are listening, from one ally to another?
I think you're incredible. Stay strong. It can be a very tough space, but know without any doubt in your mind that you are on the right side of history, the absolute right side of history. And that's all you need to know to survive at this stage.
Erin, this has been really a treat for me. Thank you so much for making the time and beaming in from the future to talk to me here in the United States. Keep doing what you're doing. We need you.
You are a legend, Jonah. Thank you so much. I love this. It was really enjoyable.
An enormous thank you to the wonder from down under, Erin Molin, for joining us today from the future. If you're not following Erin yet on social media and YouTube, we'll have her links in the show notes so you can start today. Also, important announcement, my newsletter has officially launched. So if you haven't signed up for that yet, you can do so at jonahplatt.com at the bottom of the page or at linktree.com/beingjewish. Y'all are the greatest. I'll see you back here for the next Bonza episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt.
Big ups to everyone who makes this show possible every week. My executive producer, Matthew Jones, story producer, Sean Livyashvili, and editor, Mike O'Brien of Rainbow Creative, consulting producer, Bethany Mandel, research associate, Samantha Greenwald, my amazing executive assistant, Josie Rothschild, social media manager, Yuval Yosha, and graphic designer extraordinaire, Noah Bell. Most of all, thanks to you, dear listeners, who even stuck around to listen to all these credits. And I freaking love you guys.